You're listening to The Fifth Estate from The Wheeler Centre. In this episode, we ask how a person navigates the change from activist outsider to influential insider. How do you balance idealism and pragmatism under pressure? From the US, Samantha Power joins our host, Sally Warhaft.
It's a thrill to be able to introduce Ambassador Samantha Power to the Fifth Estate this afternoon. She served in Barack Obama's administration for 8 years, in the first term on the National Security Council as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Multilateral Affairs and Human Rights, focusing on atrocity prevention. She then served as US Ambassador to the United Nations from 2013 to 2017. Prior to that, Samantha covered the war in the Balkans as a foreign correspondent, writing for The Economist, The Boston Globe, The Washington Post, and many other publications. And her book, which came out of that time, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, a wonderful book, won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction and caught the attention of then-Senator Barack Obama. You coined a word, upstander, which was included in the Oxford English Dictionary and attributed to Samantha. She currently works as a professor at Harvard Kennedy School and Harvard Law School, where she did pick up a degree along the way. And her latest book, which we're here to talk about, a memoir, is called The Education of an Idealist. And it'll be for sale and for signing at the end of this conversation. So, welcome to Ambassador Samantha Power.
Thank you all. Thank you.
I want to start this conversation with a topic that I just know you love because it's throughout your book, and it's a topic I love too, and it's sport. You're a sports nut.
Just what everybody was expecting.
Yeah, well, that's right. We like to surprise. And I'd like to know, it was a gift of mainly your mother, who was a good athlete herself, but why do you love it? I'm always interested in why really intelligent people love sport.
I do think that I would have done an awful lot more if I hadn't spent so many hours hitting balls, shooting baskets, watching baseball, talking about sport. I can't even imagine, again, how much more effective I would have been in my life. So it does raise the question. I mean, and my mother says the same thing. So my mother, who the book begins with my mother at the scene is her in an Irish courtroom, which is where I'm from. And I should note that my stepfather is here, Eddie, my father, really, since I was 9 years old, a Dublin doctor and storyteller. And he was the reason for this courtroom scene because she was trying to leave my father, who had a problem with the drink, and run away with this man, my stepfather, Eddie. And so the first scene in the book is, what right has this woman to be so educated? That was the question the Irish judge asked of my mother. And crazy, right? That could conceivably have happened. And it was sort of, I wasn't in the courtroom, luckily, but it was seared into my consciousness because it so affected her. And what he meant was she had gone, she'd been deterred from becoming a medical doctor as a kid, had thrown herself into sport. She was one of five sisters. They were all amazing athletes. There was, kind of one tennis racket among the five sisters, one ball you had all season. If you lost that ball, you can imagine how deflated the ball was by the end of the season. But the parents supported it. She then became a member of the Irish field hockey team, and at one point even becoming the captain of the Irish field hockey team. Meanwhile, all she really, apart from sport, all she wanted to do was be a doctor, even though she didn't have the science background. She went, got a bachelor in science at the University of College Cork, and then still just wanted to be a doctor and play sport. Those are the two things she wanted in the world. And she went on and continued with science because she was so intrigued, but she just wanted to see patients, but nobody was saying she could. She got her PhD in biochemistry in England. And while she was there, she actually soared up the ranks of the British squash circuit. She became an amazing squash player. It's crazy, right? And then while she's, playing competitive squash, she finally is like, I got to go to medical school. I got to go be a doctor. And so she did finally, and what for then was late in life, and it wasn't so common for women to be going into medicine at that point in Ireland. She went back to medical school. I was already born. We lived in Dublin. And my memories as a child are just of kind of watching the squash ball go back and forth and back as she picked me up from school or from, you know, take me away from my dad at the pub. And I just go and watch the squash ball go back and back. And so she just became the best squash player in Ireland. Meanwhile, again, becoming a medical doctor. So I was always surrounded by it at the pub. My dad was upstairs. I was in the basement, not a very attractive place to spend time. I didn't notice at the time, but it was a bit chilling when I went back. In my teenage years, and then as an adult, I was about to say as an adult, going back in and be like, oh, that's where I sat, like there, ooh. But I sat there very, very happily as my father upstairs, Jim Power, sounded off about sport. He was a great golfer, great tennis player himself, but mainly just an opinionated sports watcher. So I got the sort of playing, I suppose, from my mother, always loving that as an outlet. And then I got the pontificating from my father. And as I write in the book, all I wanted to be, when I got to go to Yale University, this incredible university. By the way, I was just at the University of Melbourne. Gareth took me on a tour. What a spectacular, beautiful campus. Reminds me a lot of Yale and Oxford and just spectacular. But I get to Yale and I have this academic bounty. And what do? I become the play-by-play voice for the Yale men's basketball team.
There's something in the fact, isn't there, that sporting games end cleanly. In your world, everything's messy. You hardly ever get a neat conclusion. You can watch a game of baseball and enjoy a completion. Is there some of that in it?
Yeah, you're probably more sophisticated on the interpretation than me. I just love sports. But no, I think it's very fair. In fact, it's funny, I hadn't thought of it until you posed the question that way, but in government, we had this expression, as it turns out, a newsflash, I'm no longer in the U.S. government with this president, but we had this expression, which I don't know that I'd heard before government, which is that of clean wins. It's very rare that you get a clean win in government. I think I write about that at some point. We pushed the agenda that Gareth and I got to know each other over, the atrocity prevention agenda, and we stave off and what seems like an incipient massacre in South Sudan. South Sudan becomes an independent country, breaks away from Sudan because of all of our diplomatic work with China and other countries to actually ensure that the people are able to vote in a referendum and break away. And it looks like a clean win for about 5 minutes until then the parties in South Sudan start killing each other. They break away successfully without atrocities, and then they go after each other. And as soon in government, when you touch an issue and when you embrace it, and this is one reason human rights issues, there are many reasons, but where there's a lot of gravity cutting away from actually taking leadership on human rights questions, but you do something, it makes something better, and then when something bad happens, people are inclined to associate the bad thing more with you than if you'd done nothing at all in the first place. So no clean wins in government. So maybe there is something tidy about sports. But I also think I wanted to be a sports journalist. I kind of stumbled into it, or serendipity that led me on the career path I ultimately landed on. But when I was working at the White House, and whether I was frustrated because our policies weren't having the impacts I sought, or I was frustrated for more ego-driven reasons where I wasn't getting the access I wanted. I mean, just to go out and play basketball, as I did 3 times a week when I was working at the White House, to bang a squash ball around. I mean, it's also just an outlet, and it's a way to, I suppose, let out your frustration rather than acquire new frustrations, which, of course, it sometimes can be depending on how you play.
And a great history of diplomacy, too, in sport. And, you know, some of the...
Absolutely.
It was Melbourne in 1956, Olympic closing ceremony, that introduced all the athletes coming out together, mingled as one. I think our only great contribution.
Well, maybe just to pick up on that. I love that. I didn't know where that came from, and it's so. I mean, I cry in every opening
ceremony. It's beautiful.
It's so beautiful,
yeah.
And who they choose to carry the flag is often kind of, rooted somehow in dignity or issues. You know, sort of progress that has been made or that needs to be made. It's very, very moving. I think we in Moscow, if I remember. At the recent Olympics, the Sochi Olympics, we had our LGBT athletes, one of our LGBT athletes, I think, carrying the flag, if I remember, just to sort of send a message to Putin. I just wanted to, just briefly, because when I was UN ambassador, we'll bounce around, but for the first time was in a kind of public-facing role and you know, almost without deserving it or without even being known in a particular country that I was visiting, the fact that I was UN ambassador and one of relatively few, there were about 37 female ambassadors out of 193 countries at the UN, including most recently Gillian Bird, Australia's ambassador to the UN, a fellow female ambassador. But when I would go, for example, to Boko Haram territory in Nigeria or Cameroon, I'd play basketball with local girls, or when I went to Mexico, I played soccer with underprivileged kids. I played basketball when I went to Israel and the Palestinian territories in a kind of mixed, setting where Seeds for Peace or these organizations bringing Israelis and Palestinians together through sport. So I also find it a great equalizer, fundamentally. You know, here I am, a stiff diplomat coming in with my, armored car and my security detail and looking very intimidating. And next thing I'm in my gym clothes and I'm getting, I'm trying to shoot and getting blocked by, some teenage girl. And then the conversation that happens afterwards about their aspirations, it's just a completely different conversation than it would have been. So it is a great, I think, equalizer.
You just mentioned the word dignity, and you write about dignity in the book as the importance of it as a historical force. Can you talk about that a little bit more and its importance to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say two things. First, for me, I think my first appreciation for the importance of dignity came from my Irish background. The way in which, Eddie entered my life when I was 9. This is a man who can give you every Irish fight song, every Irish poet's oratory or ode, to the Republican fallen. The idea, I remember he used the expression, Eddie, I don't know if you remember, but the Irishman having to do the tip of the forelock, right? This idea of, my husband and two kids and I now live in Concord, Massachusetts, and we've been reading, which is where the American Revolution started, we've been reading a lot about the pre-revolutionary time, and it was that same thing of kind of feeling like you have to look down, and today, of course, race, class, all of that persists, but I think that idea that occupation and denying people their voices or their agency, the idea that that was bad and to be avoided, probably somehow is in the water in Ireland as you're growing up. Then, not long after we moved to the United States, we moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and as I write in the book, I was at a school that was being desegregated by court order. And this was not, Brown versus Board of Education, 1950s, 1960s. This was 1983. So this was one of those white suburban districts that was just resisting so long. And so the good news was the court forced the school districts and those who were resisting having African Americans come to the school. And so I had this, actually to this day, probably the most racially diverse experience, kind of a sad in a way that I haven't had more experiences like that. But my first day of school in the eighth grade, when I would have been just about to turn 13, was angry, only a subset of the larger parent body, but some angry white parents kind of jeering African American students who were getting off these buses, and it was just, I just remembered like it was yesterday, just a row of those yellow American school buses and these African American kids who were getting off to have the kind of opportunity that my mother and Eddie wanted for me at this great public school in this suburb. And it was only pretty deep into my high school years that I began to really reflect on what it meant to those African Americans and actually talk to them about what it meant. So we lived 10 minutes from school. I could walk up the street, go to school, kind of basically roll out of bed with, you know, bedhead. My counterparts, who were being judged by the same academic standards as me, were getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or 4:30, taking a bus, waiting out in the cold, you know, or in the heat or whatever the season was, taking a bus to a hub where, you know, other buses were coming from all over these African-American or inner-city communities, and then taking another bus an hour to our school, Lakeside High School. And then after school, they'd have to wait around for the activity bus. They'd probably get home at 10:30 at night, you know, and yet we were, as I say in the book, sort of everybody's equal in the eyes of God, except this is very, very different experiences. And one is, you know, I would get home, be able to do my homework starting at 7 p.m. after sports. They're getting home at 10:30, having to get up at 4:30 in the morning. Totally different. And so that the question of dignity and the sort of fulfillment of aspirations and potential as a personal matter, I think, was rooted above all in those experiences. But what I came to see in government was the extent to which dignity is, and Gareth and I think really see this in a similar way, I don't want to speak for him, but the way in which dignity is also a driver of human history. I mean, I mentioned Putin earlier in a critical way, but, and there's plenty more to say in a critical way, of course, about Putin. But, you know, if you think about what he has harnessed in Russia, right, his MO is, I'm going to be the guy who raises Russia from its knees. You know, this sense that we had begun to look past, we the United States, maybe Australia as well, but that you know, people were, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we would just look past Russia, talking about winning the Cold War over and over again, and why that would then create an opening for somebody of Putin's instincts and tendencies. The Trump phenomenon, right, him winning, or the other Trumpies, you know, the Trump lights that exist in other parts of the world, they're very much harnessing, again, a sense among a pretty substantial number of people that history is kind of leaving them behind, you know, that they're being looked through or looked past, especially with multiculturalism and diversity, and as the complexion, quite literally the demographics and the complexion of the United States changes, there's a community of people who really have felt, again, that their dignity is not seen. A community of other people, too, there, I'm not, again, excusing racism or God knows white supremacy and the kind of hate, frankly, that has been unleashed. But I think when you look at the 2012 election and then the 2016 election, one has to ask the question, why did 9% of the people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 shift to Trump in 2016? And I think dignity is a part of that story. The Arab Spring is almost entirely a story about denying people's agency. You know, what is it like when there's so much corruption around you and you can't vote someone out? You're just stuck, right, with the same corruption, the same repression, and that just longing embodied in the Tunisian fruit vendor, right, who just couldn't stand it anymore, set himself on fire as a protest, but also as an act of despair. So I think in so many places, it's not something that people in policy world necessarily go looking for. Like, how are you doing on dignity today? But I do think that we ignore it, this issue, at our peril.
Well, I think it's also one of the reasons Obama wanted you in his room, isn't it? That somebody needed to be thinking about these things. You write about election night 2008. And you describe...
I prefer that one to other election night I write about.
I wasn't sure which year
you were going to say.
We will get there, but let's just enjoy this for a while, shall we? We'll get there. You describe Obama that night, the election night, as isolated and alone. The usual spark of mischief in his eyes seemed to have vanished. And then you go on to say that just 2 months into the job, he was different. And I'm interested because so much of your work is about people with power and what it does to them and what it perhaps should and shouldn't do. How does immense power change people? And how has the power that you've had, which was immense, changed you?
I'd say in Obama's, just go specific and then maybe generalize, but for someone who has that amount of power as effectively leader of the free world, and with all of the security threats to him and to his family that being President of the United States carries with it, first and foremost, power for him was immensely isolating. And I write in the book, book of sports, Obama, as some of you know, loves basketball, loves playing basketball. While he was president, it made less sense to me why he was suddenly really preferring golf to basketball. And the answer was that it was just one of the few places where he could just be in a wide expanse, that his life had sort of shrunk and spontaneity had been, if not eliminated, really, really reduced in his life. His ability to just go out and talk to folks, his way, his kind of channel to the outside world became what folks who worked at the White House called the Letter Underground. And it was a group of young people in the correspondence office of the White House who went through thousands of letters that came to the White, or emails that came to the White House every day, and chose five for Obama to go home with in his book, in this little binder. And he would cling to this binder. It was like a lifeline to the world that he would not be a part of for 8 years. And is, you know, once you're president, it sort of carries forward as well. It remains very isolating. So he was special in so far as he became. You know, at least a national politician so late in his life. I think he was already, you know, again, late 30s, early 40s, I suppose, early 40s, when he was elected to the U.S. Senate. And so sometimes I think when, you know, no offense to any career politicians who are here, but I think if you've had a life, he's been a constitutional law professor, he'd been a community organizer, his credit card had bounced 4 years before the convention speech that he gave that, you know, took the world, or at least America, by storm. He'd gone to the prior convention in the year 2000 and couldn't get in because his credit card bounced. And so he'd lived, you know, a lot of the issues that he knew were affecting working people in the U.S. and really struggled, you know, as a father to juggle all that was required to support his family, along with Michelle, of course. And so he finds himself then just cloistered. I mean, that's the word. And so these letters are like his way of, okay, what's actually happening? How are my policies affecting real people? Occasionally he would bust out. I mean, it really, really rarely. And people would send emails around to say, the bear is loose. The bear is loose. And he, you know, so there's some video online you can find of him like going up to people who are buying ice creams like on the National Mall near the White House. And, you know, as he's walking out of the White House gate, he's literally saying, the bear is loose, the bear is loose. And these people are like, wait, what? So I think, mentioning that he was special, his self-awareness led him then, as you said, to want as much diversity of viewpoint around him. He was pretty self-aware also about the tendency to suck up. That's obviously what Trump most desires from the people around him. Mm. In Obama's case, if there was too much of that, he would use the phrase happy talk. Mm. Be like, what's this happy talk? You know, last I checked, things don't look like they're going very well in the Middle East. Like, why am I hearing how everything's under control? It's clearly not under control. And he would really interrogate and push back. But that level of isolation, the risk of, even in a democracy, you know, as established and vibrant as American democracy, and even with a president like him, but the risk of sycophancy, you know, is in systems, and anybody in business knows this as well, and yet that is so maladaptive when it comes to policy. And so he was very good, I think, and I was part of that for him, but only a very small part, of trying to counteract what he knew to be these isolating and limiting features of his new solitary life, you know, through... you know, in structural ways, by having, you know, ensuring that a human rights person was in the room when he knew that if we took a strike, you know, in a theater of war, almost inevitably you were going to hear back. Everybody we that was killed in the incident, sir, was, you know, our intended targets. That would be the first report back, and he'd look at me and be like, Sam, you know, is that, are there groups outside who are saying something contrary? Okay, well, now if there's a divergent viewpoint, can we look again? Can we see? Do we need to pay compensation? You know, how did this happen? Can we learn from it? How can we avoid it happening again? So that was him. I think for me, I felt my government self and especially my UN ambassador self was pretty continuous with the person I'd been. Like, I felt like...
Well, that's the heart of this book, isn't it? The education
felt,
of an
it
idealist.
It felt continuous, but I also, like him, would have... I'd be self-aware enough to be skeptical that that could be true, right? I mean, I didn't used to, when I was a reporter with my backpack and my notebook and my wad of dollar bills, you know, going to a war zone, I didn't have a security detail. I didn't have, I mean, the same risks, or, you know, Obama at a totally different level, but of people telling you what you want to know rather than what you need to know, those exist in any institution. And so when I ran the U.S. mission to the UN, that was a risk with my team. But I think... Again, having written, spent 5 years researching and then writing A Problem from Hell when I was in my 20s and early 30s, I was relatively alert to the risks of bureaucratic isolation and what I called in my prior work the psychic numbing that can come from talking about policy in these kind of antiseptic ways that happens. And so I had a number of things that I went in as UN ambassador knowing I was going to do, like travel as often as I could out of New York and out of Washington to sort of get out to see the people who were either the beneficiaries or the you know, the people who were suffering negative consequences from the decisions we were making. I also started, I didn't write that much about this in the book, but when we would have Security Council meetings, which could be the most antiseptic of all, you know, where you felt like the talking points sometimes that you were given by your own government were so timeless, you know, that Madeleine Albright could have used the same talking points almost 20 years before when she was UN ambassador, and the same with other governments, that there was a sort of performative but also sort of just routinization of discussions rather than the kind of diplomacy that we needed to be doing. And so I tried consistently to bring people also from conflict areas to New York to just shake things up. So when Russia was denying chemical weapons use, we brought two doctors who had treated chemical weapons victims in Syria, two Syrian doctors, and had them play their videos of the patients who'd been sort of frozen, suspended, you know, by these gas attacks. When we were talking about sexual violence, to have somebody like Nadia Murad, who's now famous, but I brought her to her first international event where she testified at the Security Council, and we'd been having meeting after meeting on ISIS, you can imagine. But, I mean, until she spoke about what it was like to watch her brothers be executed in front of her and to be sexually enslaved for more than a year by ISIS and what that entailed, I mean, I feel like people, even ISIS, which posed a threat to everybody, felt much more abstract before than it did after she came and drove home those consequences. So I think, you know, again, I think I knew the risks, and I at least did my best to try to neutralize those risks. Others would be better judges as to whether I succeeded, I suppose.
When you take on any new job, often it's the things that you're not worried about that turn out to be the biggest challenges, and the things that stress you or don't even make your top 20. When you became the ambassador, let's look at Syria, because it you open the book with it, you close the book with it. It's right through the book as the crisis that I felt you regretted the most, that troubled you, continues to trouble you the most. About what the barriers are that we can't see when we're like you, and you know, we've read the book A Problem from Hell. If you were writing that book today, how would you write the Syria crisis into it?
Well, I would write the book that exists out in the world weirdly, and again, I hope this doesn't sound defensive, but I would write exactly the same way, because I did. a problem from hell, and this is what gave help, you know, this was also the logic of the responsibility to protect, is the logic of the responsibility to protect, but it's about a toolbox and about having a vast array of tools, and where when we're thinking about how to respond to mass atrocities, whether the Rohingya, Syria, Rwanda, that we can't think in these binary ways, which we often do, which is, especially in the U.S., you know, is it in our national interest enough to be contemplating doing something militarily? If not, it doesn't even rise in the system, so you don't even do the diplomatic things. You don't, you know, mobilize UN solutions or sanctions or create protected areas or even just try to spearhead, you know, some kind of diplomatic effort where you bring all the stakeholders together. It is relegated to such low levels just through history, and that was the point of A Problem from Hell, to say presidents need and world leaders need to prioritize this. Then it will rise more quickly. Then we can see if there are low cost tools that can be employed. But I don't think A Problem from Hell treated the toolbox, as I call it, as a panacea. And it basically made a very fervent plea that there be a toolbox, and that we're really examining those tools at the highest levels in a really timely way. I think if I added a Syria chapter to your question, it would be a chapter that shows the limits of the toolbox, because it exposes that there are certain examples, and again, 500,000 people to date have been killed in Syria. You know, it is one of the most egregious examples of a mass atrocity in the last century, never mind, and certainly with Rwanda, the most egregious in my lifetime. But it really did isolate. We had exhausted every tool in the toolbox short of the hardest one to grapple with, which is the use of military force. And even though I advocated the creation of a no-fly zone, for example, to be very, very clear, creating a no-fly zone for the United States military would have required taking out all of Assad's air defenses, including air defenses where, especially at the tail end of the war, Russian military officers were based, helping man those air defenses. And so the idea that there was kind of some other tool in the toolbox that we could have employed at low risk, that was false. So the question then, and this is what I detail in the book, is how much risk should Obama have incurred in light of the human devastation that was being perpetrated by the Assad regime, Russia and Iran, and then later by ISIS, which took advantage of the larger conflict and the atrocities to establish a foothold there. My view was that apart from those human consequences, there was the mass refugee flow. I did not predict that refugee flow, that in a way, I mean, I would have made arguments and did make arguments about the destabilization of Jordan and Lebanon, and basically would have had the sense that the kind of dam is going to burst. But what I did not foresee was that the dam would burst, refugees would flow forth into Europe, encouraged, of course, by President Erdogan, and that would arguably change the face of European politics, never mind the future of the United Kingdom, vis-a-vis Brexit, for generations. I mean, so the knock-on effects were even worse than those that I would have been arguing about. And the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, and then the legacy of those flows, you know, now we're living with that limbo and what to do legally with people who've been apprehended. But so many of our nationals, Australian and American nationals and European nationals, going to this war zone. So there were, to me, in the cost benefit, that is what I would have written about in A Problem from Hell, to me, any tool that we were contemplating using carried with it such risks. Like Obama absolutely was alert to those risks, especially after the Iraq war. But I felt we weren't doing a great job, and argue that we should do a better job weighing the risk of, let's say, moving to a no-fly zone or carrying out limited military strikes in the wake of the chemical weapons attack, weigh those risks, which are real and are often, I feel like, diminished in when people criticize Obama, very real risks. But if you weigh them against those other risks, then that becomes, a tool in the toolbox, I think, that becomes something that you might be more inclined to deploy. But Obama was unpersuaded. I mean, he saw the risks And again, to be fair, when we're, this is really important, when we're in the Situation Room looking at the map, particularly after 2013, you know, he would call on our Syria experts. I was not a Syria expert by any means, even if I learned more about Syria than I ever imagined I would, but he would call on the people who'd lived and worked there and who spoke Arabic and so forth, and he'd say, that icon on the map, who is that group? And the person would be like, well, I don't know, sir. They've actually, that group just is a splinter group from this other group, you know, which is located here. We're not actually sure how extremist it is or where, who's funding it or you know, what its aspirations are vis-a-vis the future of the Syrian state. You know, and he'd be like, well, what about that group? Negative, sir. Don't have any insight on that group. We'll get back to you, sir, as soon as we can. Not clear that will be this month. You know, I mean, so that's where you really, by being in government, I tried to capture that in A Problem from Hell, but the humility that you're left with also about the limits of your knowledge, I think, is an important dimension of it. And there, through American history, of course, more humility would have served us well. But you can then just max out on what those other tools that I mentioned can achieve, particularly with when Russia is standing in opposition to doing anything multilaterally. Then you really, your toolbox becomes quite a small one, and that's what it felt like in Syria. You know, sheltering refugees, providing humanitarian assistance, launching diplomacy, sanctioning, using economic sanctions, including with our Western allies. But that has nowhere near the force of when you have the U.S. and Russia, China, the other major players, you know, all on the same page. And that was something that never happened in Syria.
One of the tools that seems to never get a chance to be taken out of the box is really early intervention. A country like Turkey is a good example. There's a terrific book by a Turkish journalist, Ece Temelkaran, who's had to go to Zagreb. She's sort of in exile there, but How to Lose a Democracy, where she's gone back and looked at the seven key things that she says were really easily identifiable that happened in such recent times, and urging other democracies to look for these early warning signs. And is there ever going to be room for the United Nations, for Washington administrations, to be actually looking really early on? Or is that done but we just don't see it?
And when you're using the word intervene, you mean diplomatic, yes. Like high-level diplomatic, yes. Attention of the kind. I think that I think, you know, so much of the, and I sort of fall prey to this a little bit in the book, but so much of the recrimination and the self-flagellation that we do about Syria, understandably, again, given all the negative consequences and the knock-on consequences, that debate tends to be very much about the red line and, you know, should Obama have used force, should he have created a no-fly zone? I think there actually should be way more criticism of us of the early phase in 2011 to 2013 before the major gas attack, where the kind of painstaking diplomacy that John Kerry did 2014 to 2016 was not done. And there is a reason for it, and this is maybe too inside baseball, but just recall that the U.S. would have had no diplomatic channels really in that period with Iran. Those would come later. Subsequent to the launch of the process that would ultimately give rise to the Iran nuclear deal. And so that was a major stakeholder that the diplomacy we did was kind of neutered because we didn't actually have all the players at the table. Politically in America, it would have been toxic, particularly because of how Republicans were acting toward Obama generally. You know, for us to have had, again, associations while Iran was pursuing its nuclear ambitions and while it was doing these terrible things in Syria and beyond. And so I look back, I wish we'd broken, sort of ripped the Band-Aid off and confronted that taboo earlier and pulled together that kind of high level. It had to be high level because none of the players in Iran, Russia, any of the, you know, the Gulf states at a lower level, none of them would have had the authority really to, this was such a high level thing for so many countries, so it would have needed to be high level. Then the other part of policy that I think people don't, that I now have a much richer appreciation for, is bandwidth. It's such a boring point, but just actually the fact that John Kerry or Hillary Clinton or Samantha Power or Gareth Evans can't be in two places at the same time, and I mentioned that now in the context of Trump, of course, really hollowing out famously, of course, our diplomatic corps. I mean, we need more, not fewer diplomats. We need higher level diplomats who are very seasoned and who have that kind of convening clout that very few people do. But you feel, even working for, you know, the superpower and working for a president who had respect around the world like Obama did, you feel the desire to clone your colleagues, and so that you can, that what John Kerry did for the Iran deal, remember he went to Vienna and he was there for like 80 days closing out that agreement. When he's there, he's not in a position to be doing that for Syria. So it just underscores how important it is to have a roster of high-level people, and how the UN, which you mentioned, you know, having statesmen who have served at a high level for their governments, perhaps, brought in, you know, at a very high level as the envoys with the kind of convening clout that they need to get other countries to back their efforts. That becomes extremely important.
It's China that's opening the embassies and consuls at the moment while America and Australia close them. Yeah.
Correct. Doubled its foreign affairs budget. The Chinese government has doubled its foreign affairs budget since 2013 at a time where, again, the number of right now in the U.S., as I write, I think, at the end of the book, but the U.S. has almost more people now serving in Pentagon, in U.S. military marching bands, than we do in our diplomatic corps, just to give you a sense of the disparity, the militarization of the toolbox.
We had a young guy here, I think it was early last year, Pat Kinane, who worked as a wrangler, press wrangler in the White House with Obama for 6 years. His office was about 30 feet from the Oval Office. He was the most low-ranked staff member in the administration, really, but he had the best desk. And he started off as a media monitor. Anyway, he confessed while he was here that for 2 years, Hillary Clinton in the Obama administration was referred to only as president-in-waiting by almost everyone that he came across.
No, that's crazy.
But the attitude was there, surely, that everybody thought Hillary was going to win the presidency.
Oh, absolutely, but not... No, I mean, I'd say there was a sense sometimes that she was more risk-averse, maybe, but she's risk-averse by temperament, I think it's fair to say, other than early on in Bill Clinton's presidency when she took the great risk of taking ownership of the healthcare effort, and I think that was very chastening for her and made her kind of more conservative in the Senate, pretty conservative, relatively conservative Secretary of State. So, but flash forward. So that's, remember, she's at the White House for the first 4 years. So she doesn't start running for the presidency until 2 years after she's come out of it. But absolutely, when she left, with the popularity she had domestically, with the fact that she was well known, you know, Obama had been the upstart who had displaced her. I mean, people really expected her to have been the candidate to run against John McCain in 2008. The Obama campaign, as I write in the book, came as a big surprise to everyone, including those of us who work for Obama, that it was actually working what we were doing. So, the fact that Bernie Sanders was almost alone in challenging her, and he was seen as a socialist and initially not taken terribly seriously by the mainstream, spoke to this sense that there was almost like a formality. And that was a mistake she made, I think she would be the first to admit, in the primary process to treat Bernie as kind of some pesky, impediment, really, to just getting on with getting the nomination and running against the Republican. But then once she gets the nomination and runs, particularly once Donald Trump became the Republican nominee, I mean, it absolutely seemed like a foregone conclusion that she would win. My husband, Cass, who I met on the Obama campaign, and I should say, for those who are feeling that this is a dense kind of policy discussion, my book is very much about sports a little bit, but romance, a lot about romance, failed romance initially.
And then a very successful romance.
I met my husband, Cass, on the Obama campaign when he accidentally sent an email to the entire senior staff of the Obama campaign in the early days of the campaign, in which he basically slammed the entire effort, saying, isn't this law effort that we're making on the campaign, terrible, as in worse than, say, anything. So he sent that email to one person, but accidentally autofilled the entire senior staff of the Obama campaign. And I, as I write in the book, had done something very similar not long before, where I had been set up on a blind date and had had a horrible time on the blind date and had been very upset at the person who set me up with the person I went with on the blind date. Because as those of you who have ever been on bad blind dates know, the first thought you have is, what does he think of me that I would have liked this random person? So I send my friend Tom, who set me up with this guy, this note savaging the blind date, and end the email to my friend saying, it just goes to show, or you could always must always bear in mind, you can only make them dress better. In other words, none of these things that are were terrible about the blind date or the person, from my standpoint, were redeemable. All one could hope to do was potentially improve the fashion sense of the person. So I sent this email. I had sent this email. This was a few months before Cass's screw up. And as you know, as soon as I hit send, I heard a ping, and it was the email I had just sent to Tom, my friend. And then I heard a second ping, and it was an email from Tom, my friend, saying, you didn't. And then I wrote back and I said, I did. And I had sent accidentally this email savaging this blind date to a listserv of thousands of genocide survivors, activists, and scholars. And even when I was UN ambassador, people would still come up to me and say, just goes to show, you can only make them dress better. So I had had this mortifying experience, and so when Cass did his thing, I just reached out to him just as a kind of empathetic person. But anyway, we're now married with two children. But why was I mentioning Cass? Was there a larger, what the hell were we talking about?
We were heading towards Trump, and you diverted stunningly.
Oh, Cass. Yeah. Cass. Yeah, anything to avoid talking about Trump. No, Cass and I would have, yeah, thank you for bringing me back. Cass and I would have this debate during the nomination season in 2015-16, where he would say, absolutely, we do not want Trump to be the nominee. And I would say, are you kidding? That would be the best thing that could happen, because then it'll be so much easier for, presumably, Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton, to defeat the Republican. Our country's split down the middle, and Trump... surely everything we now have seen of Trump and everything we knew about Trump then, that would be enough to drive people away. And I would point to polls that showed the slim percentage chance that people gave Trump versus like a Marco Rubio. Whereas Cass would say, okay, but things that are 15% likely, he's so annoying this way, but things that are 15% likely happen 15% of the time. Mm. And I was like, yeah, but Rubio has, you know, let's say, a 50% chance. And so let's go with the... And he said, but Cass would say, but can you imagine what it would be like if Trump were actually the president? Don't we want to eliminate the risk that Trump would actually... Not that our votes or views mattered, but it was this interesting thing of, like, lower probability of something completely horrible happening versus a higher probability of something not good happening. And I will never make the same mistake again. I think Cass was completely right. But we absolutely thought, I mean, in a very, on one level, humorous, but also dark parable in some ways, I held in 2016, where I thought you were taking me earlier, an election night party where I invited all the female ambassadors from the UN, 37 of them, Gloria Steinem, Madeleine Albright, first female Secretary of State, and a documentary film crew. You too can watch my election night party on an HBO film called The Final Year, as we start, like, hey, happy, happy, and then you just feel also what it means to women around the world. Like, you know, for the Vietnamese ambassador, again, one of 37 out of 193 countries, not that many women even to this day who represent their countries at the UN, for her to show up at an election party, given how risk-averse she would be in her system and how verboten it is, until Trump, of course, but to intervene in other people's politics, or to be seen to have political preferences in other people's elections. Trump now is weighing in left and right, Brexit, you know, who he wants to win in this campaign or that campaign internationally. But it's generally totally not what you're supposed to do as a diplomat. But the fact that she would come, or that others like her would come, was a testament to the fact that they just didn't think there was any risk. that this would ever be noteworthy because Hillary would win, and that would mean so much to women around the world that that glass ceiling had been broken, and maybe there'd even be cascading effects elsewhere, soft power and the rest. And just the shock of all the undecideds breaking that way at the last minute was really something that I hope I never have to relive.
Well, I reckon take a big breath on that. I mean, I'm a pessimist, and at the moment I just can't see anything but a Trump second term.
Feels emotional. That doesn't feel grounded.
Yeah, perhaps it's to, you know, to avoid disappointment.
You're protecting yourself,
Samantha.
I understand.
Yeah.
Can I give you the antidote to pessimism?
Please.
So no, I'll give you some facts that don't. I mean, there's absolutely, it's going to be a very close contest. But my first antidote to pessimism is a great line that I quote in the book from Amos Tversky, the late great Israeli thinker, who said, "Don't be a pessimist. If you're a pessimist, you suffer twice." So you suffer as you're dreading it, and then when it happens, which is, by the way, of course, as he's saying, he's an optimist for this reason, because why be a pessimist? It's about the most pessimistic thing you can say, of course, because in defense of optimism, you show you're a great pessimist. Okay, so that's that. But on the actual election, I mean, it's going to be really hard, right? And it depends, of course, who the nominee is, but I think people who say, you know, that the far left candidate can't win swing votes. There's some evidence to that effect, that the further left you go, it would be hard to win the center, of course. But the far left candidate has way more likelihood of, and when I say far left, further left, let's say, but has way more likelihood of bringing out young people, and in some cases bringing out, you know, people from non-college educated voters who actually swung from Obama to Trump, who were part of that. The 9% again in 2012 who voted for Obama and shifted to Trump, the dignity contingent, some of them at least, and so that the leftist appeal to working people could become more compelling over time, and then you have people in the center who, you know, aren't yet generating a lot of enthusiasm among young people, but could bring Republicans and independents and those horrified in general by the current president back into the fold. 7% of the voters who voted for Obama in 2012 stayed home in 2016. So this question of turnout more than persuasion is a huge part of the equation, because our election was settled by 78,000 votes in three states. So, but I think the combination of the number of women who voted in 2016 was way down from 2012, even though we had the chance to elect our first female president. That's not going to happen again with Roe v. Wade and, you know, freedom of choice hanging in the balance, with Trump now having proven he's very, very capable of winning. You know, a lot of voter suppression came from overconfidence going into that election, believing that Hillary had it in hand because the polls showed her having had it in hand, or seemed to show that. And so, you know, I think right now, this is the, as I write, for this really helped, this time helped Obama in his journey, in the sense that when you go through this, what I know often foreign audiences find such a frustrating, they're just like, pick your nominee already, just get on with it, and let's get to the you know, this is not even the semifinals, it's like, you know, the beginning of the Australian Open, 64, you know, it feels like 64 players, you know, to skinny it down, and sometimes, you know, at one point I actually thought it would be 64 candidates, but, you know, so we're in this winnowing, but each candidate is getting stronger by virtue of having had to go through this. So, and a lot of Americans are not paying attention at the present. And so it'll be what Obama said to us one very depressing evening when he unexpectedly lost the New Hampshire primary, having beaten Senator Clinton in Iowa when he was seeking the nomination in 2008. He said, when we're done with this, you know, in effect, this battle against Senator Clinton and much of the Democratic Party establishment, he said, we will be like steel that has been forged and fortified. We will be ready for the race against the Republican. And so this kind of chaos and, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin kind of distinctions that are drawn, or this, the fact that many in the nomination race are being push to the left and potentially will have a hard time pulling back to the center. I mean, all that is happening for sure, But at the end of it, you really do want the candidate who has withstood all of this and prevailed in this, especially because they're going to go against not only Donald Trump, but remember, he's done nothing to protect our election infrastructure. That would be another reason for actual pessimism. And it's not by coincidence he's not doing it. And it's not only because he's afraid of delegitimating his own victory. He doesn't ever want to talk about Russian interference because he doesn't want to buy in any way to the idea that he wasn't elected fair and square. But it's also because he wants to keep open that possibility again, right? Of drawing. I mean, he's just proven himself with Putin, but also now with Ukraine. Just foreign policy is just one tool in his toolbox for personal self-aggrandizement and in political and financial enrichment. And so it's going to be ugly. But there are so many people who didn't vote or who switched, who are having serious buyer's remorse or stay-at-home remorse.
We've had a pretty miserable political year in Australia in terms of a lack of inspiration. There's a lot of moments you could pick as the worst moments, I think. For me, it was the state dinner and having to watch an Australian Prime Minister be charmed fed by this man. And I had, you know, lots of I understand diplomacy enough to see that it's hard to turn down that invitation. Perhaps we could have done a little less to attract ourselves to getting it in the first place.
I suppose, right.
And so on. But at what point, with the dismantling of institutions, with the behaviour that he's set, does diplomacy, where's the red line there for a country, whether it's Australia or someone else, to just say, you know what, we don't want this invitation to dinner because we don't want this disruption anymore?
Yeah. You know, I think it's, I mean, they could easily, to be very, very clear about how state dinner invitations work, not to burrow in the specifics because it's the general question, I think that's interesting, but you don't get a state invitation if you don't go looking for it. So it's not like, I mean, this was sought.
That's what I suspected.
Yeah, it's not like, oh my goodness, did you see what we just got? What a wonderful or horrifying surprise. There are very few state dinners. I think Trump's done maybe two, three. But I think, you know, I have some sympathy for, you know, a country like Australia where the U.S.-Australian relationship militarily, in terms of intelligence, in terms of people-to-people, I mean, this is a really thick and important relationship, I think, to both of us, but certainly given how the power of America's economy and all the traditions we have, it's not easy, right, to navigate this. I think to do some of the more fulsome embraces of Trump's, certainly to act in any way like Trump, that would be, I would judge that harshly. And to do anything as part of our democracy in the same way that I was being critical earlier of Trump doing things in other people's elections, I think to do anything that looks like it's playing into the American political debate, I think that's a mistake, and that's pushing it too far. But to maintain, I mean, you know, the bilateral relationship is going to turn in some measure on more than probably with any other president, on Trump's personal predilections and whims. And so, you know, I cut some slack to leaders who feel like they have to engage, and he's all about flattery, and so it's also very hard to have the kind of reasoned, you know, kind of even at times, you know, friends don't let friends drive drunk, right? That, you know, that you could imagine offering counsel to a friend, but that's not the kind of leader that Trump is, and so it ends up being, you know, a kind of unbecoming, pretty demeaning, I think, for most leaders who are in a position of kind of having to flatter. And then they look at home and they see that Trump has no political standing. I mean, again, it's not as if he's as unpopular here as he is in some places. Like in Ireland, the country of my original country, I mean, he has almost no popularity whatsoever. And so it's hard for a leader to kind of do what they need to do for the national interest, maintain the relationship, and not also sort of jeopardize their own standing at home. But I think you can draw those lines. I don't think that's that hard. If I may just say something, because we've been sort of in a policy place and maybe a little bit of a dispiriting place, I do, the point of what I've tried to do in the memoir, especially in writing it so personally and in a very raw way, I write about, you know, alcoholism and addiction and some of the things that I've carried with me, rightly or wrongly, as sort of, you know, things I wish I could undo in my own past. But writing about IVF and being a working mother and really trying to open all of that up. You know, we can have as many conversations, especially in the States, as we want about what's likely to happen in November 2020, or especially, I'm just taking your word for it, if you feel like you're lacking inspiring leadership here, or it's not as inspiring as it once was. And there's just, you know, there is so much to talk about and to kind of, one can spiral pretty easily, but the reason I've written this book so personally, which I never thought I would, in Ireland, there are people who say Irish people have trouble using the first person even in therapy. And I would be one of those people, as one who writes at length about needing to do therapy, and I write about therapy in the book a fair amount. Definitely to use the first person to open all this stuff up, not where I started. But the reason I do that is I think I'm trying to meet people where they are, which is often in that spiral. And I know, because I'm in that spiral a lot of the time, feeling very small next to the magnitude of the challenge in front of us, whether that's China's interference in Australia's democracy, Russian interference in America's democracy, climate change, 70 million displaced people, the growing inequality in both of our societies, and by the way, in China. You know, these problems, it's just very easy as a single citizen of the world to feel about an inch high. And what I try to show in the book is this idea of that I come to at the very end, and I came to late in my own career, which is shrink the change. You know, it's to not think that every big problem is going to be met with a big solution, because if you think that, you know you're not single-handedly capable of big solutions for climate change, for example, but to think what in lieu of just the diagnosis or the despair and the worrying, what are the small things? What is one's slice of change that one can make? You know, if you're worried about 2020 in the States, who are you canvassing for? Who are you raising money for? If you hate, as I do, the fact that America has closed its doors to refugees from all around the world at the time of the largest number of displaced since Hitler, I'm not going to be able to change Donald Trump and his view, particularly of Muslims, but of refugees and of the what the complexion of America is and what makes America great. I'm not going to be able to change Donald Trump, but I do have refugees who live in Massachusetts near me who need like rides to job interviews, linens when they arrive, and above all, because it's the least hospitable environment refugees have arrived in, arguably since the Second World War. Moral support. And so this idea of shrinking the change to something that feels within each of our scope, I think is the, in a way, again, rather than just quoting Amos Tversky and saying, you know, don't be a pessimist, you suffer twice, but it's more, what are we going to do to avoid some of the scenarios that that we know from very recent history can befall us if we surrender our agency? Like, if we care about dignity, and if we believe in the better angels in both of our societies, you know, that's not something that we can be passive about. That's going to be something that human agency is going to dictate.
Well, we're going to watch with great interest what you do next. You can't be president, of course, because you were born in Ireland.
Yeah, I don't. And you know, somebody's been asking me about that. People have been asking me about that lately. But not only can I not be president because I'm foreign born, but it is, I think, pretty likely that Donald Trump is not going to be the guy to make it easier for foreign-born citizens.
No, it's not
to
looking...
fulfill, you know. No, but I. But
you're in Massachusetts. If Elizabeth Warren gets the nomination, there might be an opening there for you in the Senate. Does that interest you?
You know, I will. I want to serve somehow again, and so I'm open to anything. But I write a lot in the book about the having two children. You have two young children as well, but having two young children in this, when I was in this 24/7 national security world at the White House, and then as UN ambassador, and one of the stories I tell in the book is being on a conference call on Russia sanctions after the invasion of Ukraine, and my son Declan, then I think he was probably six then, trying to get my attention. Me shooing him away, pushing him away, and you know, him saying, "No, it's important. I need you." And I'm like, "What?" As I'm trying to talk to John Kerry and others, and he's like, "What's the score of the Washington Nationals game?" And I'm like, "Oh, Declan, this is important." And so I kind of shoo him away. And every parent can relate, even if the content of what you're shooing your son away from is a little bit different. And he marches away saying, "Putin, Putin, Putin, Putin. When is it going to be Declan, 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 Declan?" So my focus now, apart from trying to open up the world of public service, is Declan, 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 Rian, 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 my two kids.
The book is The Education of an Idealist. You can pick it up right now, and it's just been a joy, a thrill, a pleasure. Whatever you do next, all the very best.
Thank you.
Samantha Power.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Samantha Power and Sally Warhaft, recorded live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne on Wednesday, the 27th of November, 2019. You'll find more episodes of this podcast, as well as thousands of fascinating conversations and articles on all kinds of topics at wheelercentre.com. And if you check your feeds now, you'll see there's another episode of this podcast waiting for you, our last one for 2019. We'll see you there.